Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Rose v. Petit.
May it please the court, this is Jennifer Lipinski and this is Stephen Rogers who present argument for petitioner. There are 4 minutes to rebuttal. Ms. Lipinski will open with the first amendment.
May it please the court, I will address the first 2 points of error on which the court granted read points of error 1 and 7, which deal with the case within the case issue and the sufficiency of the evidence on that issue. Mr. Rogers will then address the third point of error, number 15, which deals with the exemplary damages. I have 2 points for the court today. First is that the case within the case element of a legal malpractice case must be submitted to the jury as a separate question as a part of proximate cause. That was not done in this case.
What if the allegation of negligence is advising me to get a divorce when that either didn't need to be done or it was the cure was worse than the disease? Can you not sue for that, or do you have to ask an irrelevant question? Or?
No, certainly not, Justice Phillips. When I say it must be submitted in a legal malpractice case, what I should qualify that with is a legal malpractice case where causation turns on the outcome of an underlying lawsuit. So that's all we're talking about here. Every legal malpractice case will not have a case within the case.
Or a contested agency determination.
Like or a contested agency determination, exactly.
But this had some pleadings that you say do and some that you say did not have that element within it. Is that right?
Well, most of the case turns on whether Ms. Vitella would have been held a responsible party liable for the payroll taxes of her employer, but for the negligence of Mr. Rhodes. She also claimed that he had advised her to get a paper divorce and that turned into a real divorce and led to her having mental anguish damages and other damages. The only damages I think the jury found related to that claim would be mental anguish damages.
Which was a fairly substantial part of the total verdict.
That's correct. And the advice to give the paper divorce, I agree with you, does not turn on the outcome of the underlying case. But the thrust of the case was that he was negligent in, Mr. Rhodes was negligent in handling the tax proceeding. And so that is the case within the case that I am addressing. The court in Milhouse v. Wiesenthal started with this but-for test, which is the test of causation where there is a case within the case. We are not arguing that this is an appellate malpractice case, but just that the premise underlying Milhouse is that in a legal malpractice case where there is this underlying case, the plaintiff must prove that but for the negligence of the attorney, the plaintiff would have prevailed in the underlying lawsuit. This is called the case within the case. In Cosgrove v. Grimes, this court suggested, I think, that the case within the case can be submitted to the jury by adding the phrase, if the suit had been properly prosecuted, to the damages question. I respectfully suggest to the court that is not going to be adequate either to adequately submit the but-for test of causation where there is a case within the case. In addition to that question needing to be submitted, the jury needs guidance in most cases in the form of instruction on what the elements of the underlying case are. And I don't think that the issue was squarely presented to the court in Cosgrove. In looking at the briefing before the court there, the parties did not brief the case within the case or how it should be submitted. So although Cosgrove may be read to suggest that instruction or that question is adequate, I don't think the court had the opportunity to fully address how to submit the case within the case in Cosgrove. And I would suggest to the court that the trial lawyers trying these cases and the trial judges trying these cases need some guidance from this court about how to submit the cases in the case, because right now there is nothing except Cosgrove. Now, I think it's also important to point out that Mr. Rowe's attorney did preserve error on this issue. He objected to the omission of the case within the case question from the charge. This is the but-for test or the but-for question. It's something that the plaintiff in the legal malpractice case has the burden of proof on, so an objection to the omission does preserve error under Rule 278. This court has recently emphasized the importance of the element of causation in two recent medical malpractice cases, Kramer versus Louisville Memorial Hospital, in which the court refused to dilute causation and proximate cause in medical malpractice cases to allow recovery for lost chances of survival. And in McKinley versus Stripling, which is an 89 case, in which the court held that in informed consent cases, the charge must contain a proximate cause question. And in that case, the court held that the plaintiff's failure to submit a proximate cause question after the defendant objected to its omission waived the issue under Rule 279, barring any recovery, and reversed and rendered judgment for the defendant in that case. By failing to submit, and I have blown up here the questions that were submitted and answered by the jury in this case, and the court can see that the case within the case is wholly absent. Nowhere is the but-for question asked. Nowhere is the jury instructed on the elements of the underlying case, i.e., what would it have taken to show that Ms. Patella was a responsible person.
What do you say to the argument that by asking the jury about proximate cause, that submits the case within a case?
Well, I would say
you mentioned. Let me clarify. You mentioned the word proximate cause. Are you saying that those are equivalent?
I'm saying that in a legal malpractice case where there is this underlying lawsuit, then the case within the case fits within the element of proximate cause. But just to say proximate cause and to give the standard pattern jury definition of proximate cause does not adequately submit the case within the case. And I would suggest to the court that we really have two cases in one where there is a case within the case, and that what we're saying is there should be one broad form question on the case within the case. And then if necessary, depending on what the underlying case consisted of, if it was a negligence cause of action, then perhaps no additional instructions would be necessary because the definition of the elements of the underlying case would already be in the charge for the legal malpractice. But here, where we had a very technical tax issue of the definition of a responsible person, then you did need additional instructions in the charge telling the jury how can they determine what is the applicable law for whether she would have been a responsible person for the taxes or not. And I can give the court, I think, a fairly simple example of why this is so critical in this case. It's undisputed that Ms. Patella was a controller for her employer, but she was not an officer of the company. Her lawyer made a big issue of this at trial, that Mr. Rhodes, the attorney, failed to adequately point out that she was not an officer, she was only the controller. But under the applicable statute of the Internal Revenue Code, it makes no difference. An employee or an officer can be a responsible person. So the fact that she was the controller and not an officer made absolutely no difference to the underlying matter. Yet, the jury had no idea about that from the charge. The jury had no instruction from the trial court as to how to determine whether she was a responsible person or not.
Isn't it uncontroverted that he, with his power of attorney, consented to penalties and her payment of the taxes without her permission?
It was disputed at trial, but I think what you're referring to is there was a Form 2751, which in essence, after the IRS regional director determined that she was a responsible person, he then sent to Mr. Rhodes this form and said, go ahead and have her sign this. It is in essence an agreement to the assessment. Its effect was then to allow her, once she agreed to that, to go ahead and appeal to the district court. That's the administrative procedure. Yes, Ms. Patella's attorney made a large issue at trial about the fact that he, or their theory at trial, was that Mr. Rhodes signed that without her knowledge, without discussing it with her. Beg your pardon?
And then never told her.
And did not tell her about it? Exactly. And if that were true, that would be negligent conduct. We're not disputing that, and I want to make that clear, too. I'm not talking, for purposes of this argument, I am not here to dispute with the court whether Mr. Rhodes was negligent or not. We're talking about causation, though. And what was the effect on her rights of him signing that form? That's something else the jury needed guidance on.
Would the jury have been asked to make that decision in if the underlying case had gone forward?
Would a jury have made that decision?
In the tax case?
No, I think an administrative law judge would have probably made, or not an administrative law judge, a district judge, U.S. district judge would have made that decision.
How can a jury in a malpractice case be asked to decide what a United States district judge would have done in the other case?
A very fair question, Justice Hag. And that is something that courts in other states are trying or struggling with in these cases. And some courts say that if in the underlying case the dispositive issue would have been decided by a judge, then the trial judge should decide those issues. Other courts have said no, if it's a factual determination, then no matter if the fact finder in the underlying case would have been a judge or a jury, but if it's a fact determination, the jury can make it with instructions from the trial court. And I think that's important because all the cases in other states that have addressed that issue and have said, yes, a jury, you know, juries make hard decisions all the time, but they must have instructions on the applicable law.
Is there any way for them to make that decision without hearing, in essence, all of the evidence and argument that would be brought to bear in the underlying case?
I think that's part of trying the case within the case. It's just that. That second case has to be tried in terms of evidence, argument, and instruction on the law.
So one side in the malpractice case becomes, in this situation, the government in the underlying case, and one side becomes the taxpayer. They may not be the same. Actually, the taxpayer may be arguing against what the taxpayer would have been arguing if it in the underlying case, all to try to get a decision about how the underlying case would come out.
That's correct. And sometimes, you know...
It seems kind of unworkable.
Well, it does seem unworkable, and that's one of the challenges of trying these cases. And, you know, one of the alternatives is, of course, to have separate trials on the underlying case versus the legal malpractice case.
Except the underlying case really doesn't matter. You choose up sides, pretend like this is really a tax case, get a pretend verdict, and then you go try the malpractice case as if the pretend decision really made a difference. Because the government's not going to be there.
That's correct. Right. Of course, one alternative is to have the decision maker that would have decided the first case come in and testify about how they would have decided. That's another alternative that other courts have looked at.
So you subpoenaed a federal judge to come in and say she would have been liable on the assessment anyway?
That is one of the alternative models for how to try these cases. That has obvious problems.
Wouldn't you subpoena the circuit and say, if he did, we'd reverse it?
Exactly.
I mean, truly, doesn't it just keep going and going?
Well, it certainly can in theory, but I think, you know, as a practical matter, at a minimum, the jury must be asked the but-for question of the underlying case. Would she have prevailed in the underlying matter but for the negligence of Mr. Rhodes?
Wouldn't that require her, she had one attorney, tax attorney, she then was required through his negligence to hire another one, and then she's going to have to hire another one to come try the underlying case in the malpractice. It seems to me that that's just adding to her damages.
Because she has to hire another lawyer to pursue
the tax case in the legal malpractice.
Well, she would hire an expert witness, which she had an expert witness testify about the elements of, you know, whether she would have been held a responsible party but for his negligence and so forth. Now, we say that evidence was not sufficient,
right,
but that would come in the form of expert testimony.
Getting back to your case within the case problem, what was the specific objection to this charge? use a transcript reference for that?
Yes, it's on pages 751 and 752 of the statement of facts. And I have it here that basically Mr. Rogers objected that under the state of the plaintiff's pleadings, that this was a meritorious defense case, and that question needs to be in the form of a question to the jury instead of a straight negligence type of question. In other words, they need to ask the jury if there was a meritorious defense, and if so, was it not properly prosecuted? And if so, would a different result have been reached? And that was his objection, which was overruled on the record.
Mr. Penske, why you mention that Ms. Patea's lawyer argued strenuously about this outcome determination. She was not a responsible person. She would not, and I'm assuming Mr. Rhodes' lawyer equally argued she was a responsible person. So why was there anything about this charge that prevented the parties from fully litigating the case within a case in front of this jury under whatever standard you talk about? They argued it. They brought whatever evidence they had forward. I assume they brought the documents out there. And ultimately, why did the jury just decide that all she was entitled to back was a retainer fee because, in fact, Rose didn't do anything for her, but it didn't really cause her any damages? Why isn't that really the resolution of this whole case based on this charge?
Well, I think that you've raised a very good point that the jury must not have thought that, or we could certainly infer that the jury may have believed that she would not have prevailed anyway, or that anything that Mr. Rhodes did that caused her to be held a responsible person didn't really cause her any harm, which I think is true under the evidence because she didn't have to pay the assessment. The evidence at trial was that the assessment was paid by others. She paid a few hundred dollars or maybe $1,000 on it, which the jury apparently didn't even include in the damages. So I don't think the jury found any harm arising out of Mr. Rhodes losing the underlying matter for her. I think you're correct about that.
So my comment to you, so why weren't the parties fully able to argue the proximate cause issue in the trial case in the face of this charge?
Well, I think that the problem is that, number one, if the jury would not have found that she would have prevailed in the underlying matter but for the negligence of Mr. Rhodes, then there should be no liability. If, in fact, everything turns on, if all his negligence relates to the underlying case. But we don't have that jury question answered here. The second thing is, by not having that but-for question in there, what you have is a situation where the jury, let's say, did not think that she would have prevailed, but they still found substantial mental anguish damage. Isn't that going to be true any time if a lawyer's negligent and if the underlying matter is lost or comes out in a way that the client is unhappy with? The client is going to have mental anguish. I mean, that is a fact of litigation or a matter like this. And so by taking the but-for question out of this charge and not requiring the jury to find that as a predicate to finding damages, then we're basically saying anytime a lawyer's negligent, they're going to be liable for substantial mental anguish damages if there was a litigation matter, because quite rightly, the client is going to be upset, and there's going to be a causal link there, even though the lawyer's negligence did not cause her to lose the underlying matter.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
I have left Mr. Rogers very little time on the third point.
Did the light flash at the end?
Actually, you can stay for 16 minutes.
Was there a light that flashed at the 8 minutes?
Yes, but you kept asking questions.
Well, I'll give Mr. Rogers 5 minutes, and they had 5 minutes to the respondent side as well.
Thank you very much.
Please, of course. Thank you, Mr. Stiller. My name is Steve Rogers. I represent Christopher Rhodes at the trial of this case and also on the appeal to the Court of Appeals at the 14th Court in Houston. The point that we challenge in the last point in our application for writ of error, in essence, goes to the Court of Appeals justifying $125,000 in exemplary damages upon a finding of $500 in economic loss. There's a subset pointed out by Justice Enoch here that it must be determined what part the mental anguish damages play in a legal malpractice case in order to support the Court of Appeals ruling here. in the event the Court of Appeals is correct and that it's a one-to-one ratio, then I can sit down right now. However, this court has recognized in the Federal Land Bank versus Sloan case that where there's a negligent misrepresentation, Restatement 452B comes into play and applies to the measure of damages being limited to the pecuniary loss. In this situation, the pecuniary loss was $500. We have to look at some of the other authorities on these cases. Mallon and Smith, the noted authors that are often cited in legal malpractice claims, note that most all jurisdictions that have considered mental anguish in a legal malpractice scenario have rejected them. Now, I know that this court has often looked to California for guidance in mental anguish cases. I've recently located a Court of Appeals case out of California called Miranda, and with the court's permission, I will submit it by supplemental brief to the court. But the Miranda case in California adopts the same restatement position in a legal malpractice case and notes that in a legal malpractice scenario, mental anguish damages have got to be rejected absent some horrible finding that some other foreseeable mental anguish flows from the legal malpractice. I would submit to you it might be a case where the lawyer's client gets put in jail as a result of the lawyer's negligence. The point that you bring up, Justice Enoch, on what happens here when the lawyer charges $500 and then the client, whose expectations may have all been met, sues later and gets the return of their retainer fee. The policy question that's addressed there is should that client also be allowed to sue and recover for the $125,000 in mental anguish? There are example after example that you can think of as attorneys where a lawyer may negligently conduct some portion of a client's case and then put the client in the hole. The client suffers mental anguish, but the lawyer digs him out of it and then successfully attains all goals for the client, only to be subjected to a suit later on for that portion of the client's fee that was caused by putting the client in the hole. And if the client can at that time also sue for the mental anguish that they suffered, then that's the policy that the Court of Appeals decision seems to uphold and can then base a finding of exemplary damages on that $125,000. I'd submit to the court that it should not be the policy of this state in legal malpractice cases to allow or foster an element of damage which in essence gives rise to a cause of action for the negligent infliction of emotional distress. The court here should look back to the Court of Appeals, give it some guidance on what part mental anguish damages should play in a commercial tort, legal malpractice type scenario, and then set those damages aside, giving the court additional guidance on the gross negligence damages.
Did you object to the submission of question two and observe error?
Your Honor, I objected and suggested under the Heath versus Heron language that at a minimum, the court had to consider only, the jury could only consider mental anguish if there were extraordinary and egregious circumstances, and I tendered that instruction. It was rejected on the record, and it's in my brief as a copy.
Are you suggesting that the recovery of mental anguish damages in a legal malpractice case conflicts with this court's decision in Boyles versus Kern?
No, Your Honor, I don't. I think there are certain scenarios where mental anguish is going to naturally flow from the violation of a duty. But I do not think that legal malpractice, a violation of a duty in a legal malpractice scenario, is one of those scenarios. That's not one of the duties.
That's because, you know, commercial?
That's part of it, and the other part of it has been brought out by Mr. Pinsky that there's going to be a substantial amount of mental anguish involved in litigation. That's recognized by most of the authorities that reject it.
Supposedly it's less when you win.
Supposedly, but even the court's learned hand is cited in this Miranda case, and he says, you know, the only thing that I can think of worse than sickness or death is to have a lawsuit.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. David Furlow, to argument from respondent.
May it please the court. My name is David Furlow, and I represent Ms. Ione Batia, the plaintiff in the lawsuit below, who is the respondent here. contrary to the argument of opposing counsel, I would submit that this is the case, not so much about charge or the specific language of it, but about an attorney who seeks to avoid the reasonably foreseeable consequences of his neglect of a case, of his entry into a what was in effect a consent decree in form of that Form 2751, which occurred without his client's consent, without his client's knowledge, and on the record, without Mr. Rhodes ever having sent a copy of it to his client. It also involves the extraordinary and almost bizarre advice that the client undergo a, quote, paper divorce in order to thwart IRS collection techniques, and it involves, most egregiously, that attorney's abandonment of his client after she was in a very bad situation that he was responsible for because of the lack of finding any case law, doing any factual investigation, or presenting anything to the IRS appellate officers. So we have an unusual case here, and I would submit that any ruling that this court makes on the case will be restricted to a very unusual set of circumstances. I would also suggest that I had a number of answers to the court's previous questions regarding some of the issues suggested by these cases.
Insofar as the assessment that was consented to by Mr. Rhodes, isn't it Ms. Mattia's burden to obtain a jury finding that the IRS would have ruled favorably to her had he acted differently?
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest first that that's implied in the jury verdict that she actually had.
What
you're asking me...
What part of the... where is that submitted to the jury?
The question of negligence, although that specific question was not asked, and I would submit that that subsumed. There had to be a finding that he had negligently failed what he had been entrusted to do in order to result in this verdict, and there had to be a finding that it had caused her substantial mental anguish as a result of that. To specifically answer your question, though, the answer would be no. Not under this court's decision in Cosgrove versus Grimes, which is what Ms. Patella's attorney relied upon at the time of trial. She only had to prove four things: duty, breach of the duty, causation, and damages. That's specifically in part of the charge that's not been blown up for your examination. Those four elements were presented to the jury. When those four elements were presented, Ms. Patella's attorney was doing exactly what this court had told her to do at the time of Cosgrove versus Grimes. Now, opposing counsel...
So you said we held in Cosgrove that even if you would have lost the underlying matter, if you'd had Clarence Darrow and he did the best job he could have, nevertheless, you could still get damages in a malpractice case if there was negligence.
Even if Clarence Darrow committed negligence, if the negligence approximately caused damages, then that would be the case.
But you do have to show that you would have won but for the negligence.
Your Honor, I think that's subsumed in the presentation of the issue to the jury that would have happened without specific breakdown of that into language that's submitted in the charge.
Well, I understood the question earlier to inquire, do you agree that there must be finding, whether implicit or explicit, that you would have prevailed in the underlying matter but for the negligence that you're asserting?
Implicit, yes, Your Honor. And that would be with respect to any case that would be on case within a case basis. But this set of facts presented things outside of case within a case basis that had nothing to do with the presentation of a, quote, meritorious defense. It included the bad advice regarding the divorce, and the damages could have flowed entirely from that. It also included the abandonment of the client without even telling her that the attorney had filed Form 2751 that so egregiously violated her rights. And that is a matter that's set forth in a statement of facts. At volume 2, page 399, there was no consent on the part of Ms. Patella to the execution of the 2751. And in volume 1, page 158, where Mr. Rhodes admitted he never even sent her a copy of it after he'd executed it allegedly on her behalf and pursuant to the power of attorney on August 5th, 1987.
Your position is that in a negligence case involving case within a case, you should simply ask negligence proximate cause damages, not give them any other instructions?
No, I wouldn't take that. I wouldn't go that far. I would say, and there can be all sorts of circumstances where a jury should be advised and fully with respect to specific instructions. To the extent that Mr. Rhodes now complains of it, he waived it under Rule 278 by not submitting specific requests and instructions on those matters. And this court can look at transcript 86 through 92 about what was actually submitted, and then 94 to 96, what was submitted and what was rejected.
Why is it waiver to object to the form of a question on which the party does not have the burden?
That would not be wrong. That would not be.
I'm just saying what happened here.
No, Your Honor, it does not. Ms. Batilla had the burden of presenting the four elements. She presented those four elements. Mr. Rhodes now claims that this is a meritorious defense case. And in fact, he did complain that the charge did not include that language. But he relies upon Cosgrove versus Grimes. He relies upon jury charge 8402. And 8402, which is the whole basis of their case, that there's got to be an express question about proper presentation, relies upon a wholly different situation, not applicable to the defense of a case. PJC 8402 applies to a situation where an attorney has somehow botched a plaintiff's right or cause of action that would be reflected in a suit. Now, that is not applicable here because Mr. Rhodes did not fail to file a suit that Ms. Batilla could have brought. He did not botch a suit once it had been filed. He botched a defense. Now, PJC 8402 says, if the claimed legal malpractice involves a failure to file or prosecute a suit in which a damage question would have been proper, then the language about proper prosecution has got to be in there, in the charge or in the instructions or something to that effect. In short, Mr. Rose was not in that situation. This was not an underlying case as in Cosgrove where he failed to file a suit against somebody for causing an automobile accident.
What difference does it make whether he fails to file a suit or he fails to file a defense?
Well, if he fails to file a suit, then he has to prove malpractice, one has to prove not only that there was a good cause of action, the trial within the trial, but also that the judgment would have been collectible under Urban and Coolidge, Pennington, etc., which is Jackson, Urban and Coolidge case. In a defense, however, it's not going to be somebody else who's going to be paying the judgment. It's going to be that attorney's own client, as in Montford versus Jeter, where an attorney, a case this court decided very similar to this, where an attorney executed a settlement agreement without his client's knowledge or consent. And this court accepted the judgment rule from New York that said if an attorney executes a settlement agreement without notifying his client, without giving his client consent, then the attorney is liable for the full amount of the judgment, even if his own client doesn't pay a penny of it. And I would submit that that is here. The difference is, in the plaintiff's case, somebody else has got to pay a judgment, and that person has got to have the money so that that judgment can be collected.
The only distinction you make, though, is about collectability of the judgment. That still doesn't obviate the necessity of proving that but for the negligence that the judgment would not have been rendered as it was.
Well, Your Honor, that would relate only to one of the elements in this case, which is specifically...
You're saying in this case there's no need to prove that that your client could have paid the assessment.
That's right.
So that the judgment rule applies, but it does not eliminate the need to prove that the outcome would have been different but for Mr. Rhodes' negligence, does it?
With respect to that portion of it concerning the meritorious defense, as opposed to the paper divorce and the abandonment of the client. With respect to that, that would be true, but that's where you have Ben Stevens testifying that Mr. Rhodes' conduct fell far below the standard and actually resulted in what, that had Mr. Rhodes done what he had been hired to do, that this matter would never have gone past the administrative appeal phase, that the IRS would have taken care of. So you had not only Ms. Patillo's testimony, but you had the expert opinion of Ben Stevenson on Ben Stevens specifically on the issue of causation. He concluded that but for the negligence of Mr. Rhodes. This whole disaster would not have occurred and she would not have suffered the damages that she did.
The Court of Appeals makes this statement that had Rhodes, well, basically the Court of Appeals said Rhodes failed to go to the IRS meeting with facts and affidavits, which would have relieved Patea of all liability.
Yes, sir.
You agree that her facts and her affidavits would have relieved her of all liability?
Yes, Your Honor, I do.
And do you believe that that is critical to the Court of Appeals' determination that what was submitted was correct?
Only with respect to that meritorious defense aspect of the case. I believe that that is important there. And I would direct the Court's attention to the affidavits contained within Plaintiff's Exhibit 26, the affidavits of four employees there who were present at Randolph Burkholz Furniture Company, and said this one was an officer, not a director. They did not have the ability, the power, to direct the checks that were supposedly the basis of an IRS.
Well, I suppose there's some case law out there as a matter of law that said she was.
Your Honor,
a responsible person.
Actually, there was not. None applicable to her situation. And specifically in our rebuttal brief to the amicus brief, we presented case after case, a number of which are B, C, and D, dependencies of that, reflecting a number of cases in which various courts have said that somebody in Ms. Patea's position would not have been liable for this. So,
were those refund cases?
Those are refund cases in the Court of Claims, because that's where it actually ended up going up to the Court of Claims.
Because some administrator had said they were.
In those instances, and the administrator was rejected. I mean, that argument proved to be unsuccessful. Some are also not only Court of Claims, but also U.S. District Court.
Did she then proceed in District Court to take advantage of some of those rulings to get declared not a responsible person?
No, she did not.
She chose to go ahead and sue the lawyer first.
She sued the lawyer, that's why. Part of the reason was because if she had gone into a district court, she'd have to be dealing with a situation where a man who had received her power of attorney had consented to the assessment and collection of a $32,000 tax lien, and she'd have to go through the process of proving that he had no authorization to do it. It was against her consent. It could have been used against her in any summary judgment proceeding in federal court. She had to labor under that burden.
But isn't that to bring a refund tax action? Don't you have to agree to the assessment? Don't you, in effect, have to agree to pay the tax before you can bring a refund as a prerequisite going into the district court for a refund? Didn't everybody who went to the district court and got declared not a responsible person have to have signed one of these forms in order to be entitled to go into district court to bring the refund?
No, it could be assessed against the person, as I understand.
Without their...
27-151. They don't, in other words, Mr. Rhodes didn't have to cooperate by voluntarily selling his client down the river. They could, the IRS could make the determination itself. But by signing that, he required, as I pointed out in the amicus response brief, he put his client in the position of having to post a bond equal to one and a half times the amount of the assessment. In other words, some $46,000, and that's, you know, I believe it's Plaintiff's Exhibit 24, the actual 2751, if you actually look through that language. Now, to answer a question that you had earlier, Your Honor, about the $500, my explanation for how this charge came out this way, with $500 in economic damages and another $125,000 in emotional distress damages, is that the trial court refused to allow Ms. Patea to proceed to the jury with a Montfort versus Jeter charge. Montfort versus Jeter, we have the judgment rule that if the attorney consents to essentially an unconsented settlement, then the damages suffered by the client could be the amount of that settlement, the amount of the judgment. Here it would have been $32,000. If this court goes back to the charge conference in this case, you will see that Mr. Don Becker and Ms. Mary Hefner, who were the plaintiff's counsel, specifically wanted to go forward to the jury on that issue, and the judge overruled and said, no, I'm not going to allow that in. So they were in a position to ask the jury to give them the amount of the tax lien. There was a tax lien imposed upon this woman, and the court refused to allow it. Now, the second matter, any unpaid amount for which she may be liable due to the conduct of Christopher Rhodes, well, there weren't any unpaid amounts at that point. There were, however, and the reason we have only $500 with respect to answer number one is the amount of money actually paid or collected from Ione Patea. The way I explain it is that's what the jury says. The determined that she had actually paid Mr. Rowe. In addition to that, she lost a $614 tax refund because the IRS kept it. There were two payments that she made, which totaled $378, and she had a $32,000 tax lien imposed upon her house. Did that cause her mental anguish damages? She's got a tax lien. She's dealing with IRS intimidation efforts. She goes through what's supposed to be a paper divorce, but under the stress of all of this, it becomes a real divorce. She's having to deal with an attorney who doesn't tell her anything, and then she finds out that he, using her power of attorney, has consented to $32,000 tax lien being imposed against her. She suffered a great deal of mental anguish from all of those specific matters. Now,
how do you, Ms. Pearl, how do you respond to, I guess, Mr. Rhodes' complaint that the issue of the paper divorce comes up, that she got a divorce based on Mr. Rhodes' advice that she get a paper divorce? Ms. Rhodes says, okay, let's talk about this divorce. I want to know what you told your lawyer who got the divorce for you. Can't do that. That's privileged communication. How Mr. Rhodes says, I was prevented from inquiring into her negotiations regarding the divorce to defeat her claim for mental anguish based on his advice for her to get a divorce. Was there not, I mean, hadn't the attorney-client privilege been waived the moment she claims that her divorce was caused by his conduct?
Your Honor, the Court of Appeals, I argue that point in the Court of Appeals below. The Court of Appeals concluded that it had not, under this Court's recent decision in the Republic case. I would contend that there was no waiver of that issue. Even if there had been a waiver of that issue, it was an issue that Mr. Rhodes waived by not raising it in an appropriate format. There were various, specifically, there were various issues relating to those matters. And, for example, the TRO and the divorce petition, which were the subject of cross-examination, and his attempt to put into evidence were not listed in the defendant's exhibit list. There were a whole host of matters. I have not specifically looked at that question today because that was not one of the issues that I was told to argue here. But our brief in response to Mr. Rhodes expressly addresses that issue, and our brief in response to the amicus specifically shows the reasons why. First, there was no waiver. Second, Mr. Rhodes waived any right to complain about his alleged statement that we had an offensive use waiver of the attorney-client privilege. And specifically also that the information that her attorney would have had would have been worth product as well. And the divorce attorney could have said, I'm not going to give over my work product, but since Mr. Rhodes never did anything to specifically bring in that attorney, present him to the court, take that attorney's deposition, raise these issues to the court, he waived the issue. Justice Enoch asked if there was anything in the jury charge that prevented full discussion about all of these issues relating to causation. And in fact, there was not. There was, in fact, a jury credibility decision here where the jury decided that they believed Ben Stevens, the expert witness in Ms. Petilla, believed Ms. Petilla and rejected the contrary testimony Christopher Rhodes with respect to matters such as disclosure, standard of conduct, and other matters. Mr. Rhodes' counsel brings up the issue of negligent misrepresentation, cites to this court Restatement 452B. I would point out to this court that restatement of torts section 905B and the comment E there specifically authorizes mental anguish damages. And in response to his citation of this Miranda case from California, I would direct the court's attention to a whole host of cases, and I will submit these cases in a post-submission brief, if it pleases the court, in which numerous states have dealt with collectability of mental anguish damages and punitive damages in cases similar to this. Cases in which the courts have said that an attorney is going to be liable for the reasonably foreseeable mental anguish that his neglect of a case or his unauthorized settlement causes. And specifically, I would direct the court's attention to Rodriguez versus Horton, which is 95 New Mexico 361, and also found at 622 Pacific Second 261, a court of appeals decision from 1980 finding mental anguish damages and punitive damages in a case where there was an unauthorized settlement where the actual damages were $10,514, punitives were $25,000. Also, the case of Wagonman versus Adams, and that is at 829 F Second 196, First Circuit 1987. Wagonman versus Adams is applicable to the issues of mental anguish and also to the issues of punitive damages because in that instance the attorney had failed, had done nothing to represent his client, just as here the record demonstrates an almost total lack of action on the part of Christopher Rhodes. In that instance, the attorney came to the First Court of Appeals and said, restrict the amount of damages to the economic damages rather than these punitive mental anguish awards because clients will always have mental anguish because they're unsatisfied with the results of the case. And the Court of Appeals rejected that at 829 F. Second 202, stating and reasoning that the negligent attorney would receive the benefit of enormous windfall and the victimized client would be left without fair recourse in the face of ghastly wrongdoing. Now, we say the same should be here, and that's why Ms. Onipatia requests this court not to leave her without fair recourse, but instead to affirm the decision of both the district court below and of the Court of Appeals. She proved in the Court of Appeals, in the district court and in the Court of Appeals, that this man, Christopher Rhodes, neglected the case, unauthorized entry into a settlement agreement, had caused all of these damages. Was it necessary to put on specifically instruct the jury about the elements of the cause of action? If Mr. Rhodes thought that specific instructions were appropriate, he could have requested them. He did not request them. That's clear in the record. Under Rule 278, he has nothing to complain about here in terms of the absence of instructions when Ms. Patia's attorney pleaded the four elements that were necessary. Was but-for causation in that charge? It certainly was. Look at Rule at pages 86 and 88 of the transcript. She did what was necessary. So, in summary, Ms. Patia would request that this court refuse Christopher Rhodes' attempt to receive an enormous windfall and to reduce the amount of the damages. There was plenty of evidence, including expert evidence, to support all of the jury's findings in this case. To the extent that there are any instructions that might have been given but were left out, that's because Mr. Rhodes left them out and because they would not have conflicted, case within a case damages or instructions would not have been applicable to a broad form instruction in which part of the advice consisted of matters that didn't have anything to do with meritorious defense. In a case where the proper prosecution language suggested by Cosgrove versus Ryan is not applicable, she did what she was required to do. She had to do it. Finally, Your Honor, in summarizing the case, this court was concerned, Justice Hecht was concerned about the unworkability of jury instructions in a situation deciding whether a district court judge would have to be called as a witness, or at least that was the issue that emerged. And the real question was decided by Phillips versus Clancy, which we submitted as Appendix B, where the Arizona Supreme Court ruled no, we won't be calling the district court judges or the judges administrative proceedings, we will instead allow the attorney to use expert witnesses to present their case regarding standards of proof falling below the standard. That's exactly what Ms. Patia did in the trial court. She brought in an expert witness who established the standard of behavior, who testified that Mr. Rhodes fell far below that standard, who introduced documentary and testamentary evidence to establish that this was a woman
who did not receive the representation that she thought she would have for the man who was charged and paid to represent her, who instead sold her down the river by executing a agreement without any consent.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Pinsky will present 4 minutes of rebuttal petitions.
I've listened to all this with great interest, but I'm interested in how you're harmed by the failure to submit the case within a case issue, because the damages that would, it seems to me that if there's error in the failure to do that, that the emotional distress damages of $125,000, there's some evidence within this record to sustain that amount of damages on the basis of conduct unrelated to the case within the case provider, if we decide that emotional distress damages are appropriate in a regular, well, at any rate, if there's an error there, it relates to point number nine. As far as case within a case, the only damages on the first two submissions are $500, which is less than the amount of the fee and less than the amount of out-of-pocket damages, which would seem to me to be recoverable in any case.
Okay. That was the first thing. I think we were on the same wavelength, on the same page. On the negligent advice to get a paper divorce, which you had asked me about, and that would not be related to the case in the case. Mr. Rogers has reminded me that the trial court ruled, and the reference is transcript 28, that excluded any damages for that type of claim because the plaintiff had not pleaded that claim. So that is really not something that can support the verdict because there were no pleadings about this advice concerning the paper divorce, and the trial court refused to allow her to testify about damages related to that. Now, as a practical matter, the jury may still have, they did hear about that advice, and the mental anguish damages may have flowed from that, but we cannot rely on that as being evidence of misconduct that does not relate to the case of the case, I think, because it's not pled.
But as to the first two damage entries, you couldn't get much better result with this instruction than you had without it.
Right, but I
and
think...
And so I'm curious about the harm.
I think the harm does flow, though, from the failure to submit the but-for case. Would she have prevailed in the underlying matter but for the negligence of Mr. Rowe? Because if they would have had to answer that question, our argument is, and we laid it out in the amicus brief and Mr. Rogers in his brief, there was no evidence to support that finding. If the jury would have had to answer that question, they would have had to have answered it no. Then they would never have found any damages whatsoever, mental anguish or otherwise. And that's the harm. Is that the jury was able to skip right over that causal link between the lawyer's negligence and the outcome of the underlying matter because the question was not submitted.
If you had a Mr. Furlow argues that Mr. Stevens gets up there and says the outcome would have been different if he had provided this information to the administrative body. Why isn't there evidence, in spite of not having complete instructions up there, why isn't there evidence of proximate cause that could support this jury finding?
Well, I would submit to the court that an expert's opinion to that conclusion of proximate cause has to have some factual and legal basis. In other words, we can't just, I don't think it's our system that we can just have an expert come in and testify that without any foundation underlying that opinion. And although it may be contested, his opinion needs to be based on something. And I think it's important to point out that the way that Ms. Tillich tried this case, which she could not afford an appeal, which really simplifies this, because what she had to prevail at the administrative level, that's what they say in their research. We know what the IRS director, the regional director, Mr. Fagan, relied upon. He relied on five factors in Plaintiff's Exhibit 21 to find that she was a responsible person. Ms. Tillich presented no evidence at trial, no evidence that Mr. Rhodes could have presented in these affidavits of these witnesses that disputed or contradicted any of those facts. All those facts on which Mr. Pagan Township is a responsible person for undisputed. So our position is there's no evidence to support, no factual evidence to support Mr. Stevens' opinion that the result would have been different.
So even though the jury did not respond in a damage question to the amount of the assessment or damages related to the assessment, you're saying the failure to submit the case within a case question harmed you by virtue of those damages that were awarded by the jury, and which could not have been if they had answered the question no?
That's correct, because they never would have been able to reach the question of damages, or if they had, the answer no to the but-for question would have meant a judgment on Mr. Rhodes.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes today's arguments. The foregoing causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will now please adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.